You are listening to the sixth episode of the Get in the Mecha podcast, the anime and comic book podcast, which we take things one arc further. I am your host Jamal today, and today I present to you with a review of the Kyoto Saga arc from AO no Exorcist. Also known as the Kyoto Impure King arc, officially, I today want to go through what this arc entails, how good is it in comparison to the first season, and also, what does it do for the further arcs of which are in the manga as of now? Hopefully will become a season 3 at some point. We pray, of course, that we will get a season 3 of AO no Exorcist. I've been hoping that for years now. But that's going to do it. Let's get right into this. This is the 6th episode of the Get in the Mecha podcast, a review of the Kyoto Impure King arc. So to start this episode, as always, I will be giving you a minor spoiler warning for the first season of AO no Exorcist, which are the two first arcs of the show, anime and manga. Also, some minor spoilers for the Kyoto Saga arc. I will be trying to weave around them so it won't be intensive. Overall, I'm just going to try and avoid spoiling it altogether, as it is something that I enjoy, and I hope that maybe you can enjoy it more after watching this episode, or go ahead and watch it for yourself even. AO no Exorcist, I think, is a really good shonen series to start with, and also just one to get into in general. So, plot summary. The Kyoto Impure King arc is actually very different to the first season of AO no Exorcist, and that is really in the way that it differentiates itself not only with its antagonist, but also just in its setting, visually how it looks, and just conceptually everything feels slightly different besides the fact that they are exercising demons, of course. As we know, at the end of season 1, Gehenna's Gate was successfully closed for the time being, but as also teased, there are still threats out there, one of which is the Impure King, which is tackled in this season. So with a large turn of events, and actually meeting some of the family of our exorcists, we end up in Kyoto, and with their assistance and with also their misfortune, it ends up that our young exorcists and those at the True Cross end up having to tackle this new and very large threat, the Impure King. A few things I'll say right off the bat are, watch the OVA. Or the OVAs in general for AO no Exorcist, particularly the one that begins the Kyoto Saga arc, or Kyoto Impure King arc, is especially important. As I mentioned, this season is very different to the first, and by that I mean the story is very detached from what it originally is, or was, and therefore context means everything. There are loads of characters, loads and loads of characters, which you haven't met before, which you'll have to eventually learn about, as they do have an impact in this entire scheme of things. Another thing I'll note is that this season actually came out almost 6 years from the original season, AO no Exorcist airing in 2011. As I discussed in episode 1, it is very separate from its first season, and because of the gap and the way the Kyoto Saga arc is really, it kind of works out, mostly because they feel pretty different and they should be judged slightly differently, which I'll touch on later in today's episode. Overall, where I think the Kyoto Saga arc shines in the long term of things is that there are very appropriate setups for the Illuminati arc, which is probably one of the biggest arcs to date maybe, as well as the manga arc that's going on right now, the Blue Knight Search arc. But with the Illuminati arc, there are appropriate setups that need to be made in order to go forward. Some setups are also very long-term as well, but I think the whole dynamic between the whole team and how they're divided, similarly to how they become slightly divided in the Illuminati arc, is essential for carrying on during the series. And while we are on the topic of what is new, as AO no Exorcist Season 2 comes 6 years after its original season aired, we get an updated, fresh, new art style. The art now is touched up, the textures are renewed, everything looks great. That's not me saying AinoX's season 1 didn't look good, but AinoX's season 2 by far looks better. Everything just feels crisp. Everything on the screen feels convincing and comes to life. Although they still attempted and did this quite well in AinoX's season 1, I think it's very important, and it's pretty much my way of stressing to you that there is loads of effort put into this visually. And by the ending episodes, I can honestly say it looks great, and I can't sort of exaggerate or stress that anymore. I think the show just looks fine, it looks great. It definitely rewards what AinoX's season 1 was able to do visually, and just adds on to that. So still on the topic of what's new, I think another really big important thing is just continuity in general. That's not me suggesting that there are any continuity breaks, although continuity is uneven. It's just that the Kyoto Saga arc doesn't pick up on everything the first season did. It kind of ignores some of it. There's more emphasis upon the families of those who suffered within the Blue Knight, and the Blue Knight in general is quite touched upon, especially if we take actors such as Ryuji, which we hear that name so many more times, as we actually meet his dad in this season, as well as Shima and Konohamaru, of course. In this area, I think the Kyoto Saga arc is quite good, as it focuses not only on Rin, but it focuses on the entire team. There is quite an effort to focus on characters such as Yukio a bit more, as well as the relationship between Kamiki and Shimi, especially also those who were caught up in the Blue Knight are a really big place of development, as we kind of got some information about them. Although the Kyoto Saga arc doesn't tell you everything, that's why it's a really long show altogether, to tell you everything eventually, but we do get a good amount more insight. By the end of the arc, we get a lot, and when I say a lot, I mean a lot of Ryuji. Ryuji pretty much takes center stage with Rin, of course, the main character of this anime, as they are the two that obtain what they need, or have what is needed to take on the Impure King. Of course, I'm not going to go too into detail, as this is a minor/no-spoiler review, but what I will say is that those characters definitely receive the appropriate development, especially with the whole family circle of Ryuji, and also the development of Yukio as well, impacts Rin's development. I think it's kind of cool how we have this sort of domino effect of development between multiple characters. As a result of Rin being pushed within the first season, Yukio kind of experiences his own troubles, and evidently we see that impacts on one of his fights with another antagonist. And if you have seen the show, then you know what I'm talking about. By the end, Yukio has pretty much had this completely new phase of not only thinking, but has been affected psychologically as well by all these things of which have happened with Rin. So when push comes to shove, in this new fight, that is transferred. Also, all the pestering of Yukio on Rin has kind of had an effect to some extent, but this is a shonen battle anime, and the protagonist never listens. So, I don't really think Rin cares that much as to what Yukio has to say, as you should always be safe, or you should be doing this, or you should care about your studies, if you get what I mean. Rin still remains that character despite the whole domino effect thing that I'm talking about, that slashes what is in his way. If something stands there that is harming his friends, or people that he loves, or anyone, to be honest, he will slash it with those blue flames no matter what. And if we're on the whole theme of continuity, that is one thing that doesn't change. The whole shonen model thing which we're speaking about in episode 1 is still applicable to Aeon Exorcist, and from what I've read ahead on, and what it is now, even in the Kyoto Impure King arc, it stays the same in that sense. But if we really are on the theme of evolution, then I must state that, as always in Neon Exorcist, and in almost any anime, relationships are built, or they're developed upon, if you don't assume that they're always being added to. They can be added to negatively, as well as positively. The dynamic between characters such as Ryuji and Rin is really built upon, as their collaboration is essential for the success of this mission. Komuki and Shimi have always had this sort of wishy-washy relationship, but that is also touched on. It's also touched on later in the manga as well, so don't worry. It's not the only time of which we see these two characters interact and also have them built upon by Kato Kazue. One of the main themes of this season is relationships, which is really important, as the reason we're going to Kyoto is partially because of a wedding between some family members related to Shima. The whole thing of relationships and trust is really tackled in this season and arc, mostly because of the whole trust issues in relation to who has taken one of the eyes of the Impure King. So from that you can take an idea of who is keeping power to themselves and who wants to separate themselves from the rest, which is obviously a selfish move, but it really is tested this season. We get loads of that in trust issues, quite a few arguments as well, as we have these new characters such as the Shima brothers and the Hojo sisters who clash to some extent, and that has to be solved, of course. And then we have the main objective being defeat the Impure King as himself, spreading miasma everywhere. So a lot of things to deal with, a lot of things to think about. And I don't think that's a completely bad thing. But what I will say is that my problem with the Kyoto Impure King arc overall is that there is a lot going on. You have to pay attention to the whole marriage agreement thing, arrangement, marriage thingy, whatever you want to call it. You have to pay attention to the Impure King himself, how that ties into the whole family, and then just pay attention to everyone else and everything that's going on. And when you consider that we only knew about 8 characters in detail, or if you really want to reduce it about maybe 5 characters in real detail, it's quite hard to keep up with this many characters. And especially as you have such a new concept, being the whole Impure King, the Eye of the Impure King, all these new methods, and the method of which is used to take out the Impure King, and even this new antagonist who fights Yukio, Todo, that complicates a lot of things. And you have to really rack your brain to understand what's going on to some extent. I don't think complexity is a bad thing. I think the Kyoto Saga arc has the potential to suffer a bit from oversaturation, but that's not to say it's completely oversaturated or it's just full of random, irrelevant characters, as some of these characters do become more useful than others moving forward into the arc, and also just moving forward into the larger scheme of things within the entire anime slash manga altogether. When I look at the arc in detail in terms of levels of development and how it tries to build a sort of greater portfolio, if you will, of each character and their relationships between each other, I think the Kyoto Saga arc is very successful there. It takes what was done in season 1 and just fills it with more background. It gives us, in 12 episodes, more of an idea of who each and everybody is, with the exclusion of maybe a few characters and some of our more sideline characters, with the exception mostly of Kamiki, which I will leave aside because that's more Illuminati arc. Loads of development there. But for this season, there is a lot of attention on building the relationship between the team and exploring the notion of, or the nature of, the team and how they function under pressure. On the battlefield, if you want to call it a battlefield, or during combat, the team becomes split up, and it is the job of each team or sub-team, so that's Kamiki and Shimi, that's Yukio pretty much by himself and a few other exorcists to back him up, and Bon plus Rin they pretty much have to work things out by themselves and get the job done, because especially with Ryuji and Rin, everyone is depending on them, so that pressure mounts throughout the few episodes of which they actually go head on with the Impure King, probably some of the best episodes of the show maybe, in my personal opinion. But what I will say is that there is loads of attention to detail when it comes to building those relationships. As we know, further down, those relationships are challenged. So what's a better way of making relationships seem more genuine? And when they collapse or rise, why not have them develop to the extent where it feels impactful? And that's where I think Aonoxis really tries when it comes to the Kyoto Saga arc. It tries to make those relationships really convincing and just bulks them up with loads of character, loads of emphasis on each character and how they interact between each other under pressure. But if we pull out and we just look at the concept of everything, so the new characters, the wedding agreement, Ryuji's dad, which I don't think is a bad thing. I have nothing against Ryuji's dad, okay? Ryuji's dad's a good guy. But with everything going on, I think oversaturation is its main problem. I think the good thing about Aonoxis Season 1, or its opening arcs, was that it had a very specific goal. It might have been a long-term goal, which Rin established, I want to defeat Satan, but the entire saga with the Gehenna's Gate situation was pretty short-term, and I think that was where its glory came in. Although the Impure King arc is pretty short-term, I don't think it means much looking forward besides some setups for the Illuminati arc, but I wouldn't say it's the be-all and end-all for development. When it comes to the first season, what I think was really special was how, with the Gehenna's Gate situation versus the Kyoto Saga arc section, the end goal felt sort of meaningful, if you will. I spoke about meaning loads in my last episode, but I want to go through it a bit more. But in relation to Aonoxis, when it comes to meaning, that is really important. You need to feel as if I achieved something, or I feel like the characters achieved something. When it comes to Season 1 being the second major arc of the show, which it concludes on, I like to lump those two arcs together, but you can, of course, separate them into two and call the Kyoto Saga arc a third. But what I am saying is that when it comes to that arc, achieving the closing of Gehenna's Gate feels really valuable, because not only does it give our exorcists an achievement or an accomplishment or a small win, but it also is really important for separating Isaiah and Gehenna. I think that in itself is just really solid, but when you think of, oh, I defeated the Impure King, I kind of struggle to say what that does besides the whole small win factor. Defeating the Impure King kind of just means I defeated the Impure King. I don't think there's much that comes off it. And that is where I think the Kyoto Saga or Kyoto Impure King arc is flawed to some extent. It suffers from relevance. What does it mean to defeat the Impure King apart from the world is being destroyed? Yes, the stakes are quite high, but are the stakes just Kyoto? Probably yes. Does it probably mean a bit more? Probably yes, but what does that do? The stakes are high and arguably really high in the first season. The second season has high stakes, but I struggle to see what the point would be of defeating the Impure King. What does that do for our exorcists? Apart from defeating a threat, kind of just feels like the villain of the season versus we need to protect this side of our world from this impending and developing threat being these demons from Gehenna. But that's kind of my rant done. I don't want you to think or walk away with this and say, oh, the Kyoto Impure King arc sucks, or Jamal thinks the Kyoto Impure King arc sucks, because I don't think it sucks. This is 6 years of waiting, and for 6 years, I'm just happy Aonoxis comes back and makes something that's mostly faithful to its source material, and something that just works to some extent. And with the rant done, I think it's time to move on to probably two of my favorite parts of the show. And don't get me wrong, I like my rants, but I like voice acting. So without further ado, here is the Link the VA segment thingy. So if you're new here, I know the podcast is still new, so maybe if you just haven't seen it already, what I do is I go onto my anime list, I search one of the characters from the show, maybe two, maybe three, yeah, I do that, and then what I do is I see what characters they also voice act, and I just compare and speculate as to, whoa, that's cool, this person plays this person. Spoiler alert for my last episode, in the way that we found out that Erwin also plays Riki Nendo, and Erwin is also Jotaro. I think that's enough of an explanation in itself. Let's dive into this one, and the first character I'm actually going to choose, which I think is really appropriate, is Yukio. Yukio is really developed in this part of the show, so I think it's right that we look at who voice acted him, and who that voice actor plays as well. So the voice actor of which we're looking at today is Jun Fukuyama, and I am so shocked at what I found. I literally just looked at it now. I try to do them as blind as possible. I don't search up voice actors all the time, so when I do, it's really shocking when I find out that they play someone who I'm very familiar with or just know straight away. The main one that shocked me was he plays Koro Sensei from none other than Ansatsu Kiyoshitsu, also known as Assassination Classroom. If you've of course watched Assassination Classroom, you would know that Koro Sensei's voice is out of this world. It sounds nothing like a human. It sounds like this tickling laugh, and it's just hilarious. It sounds great. And when I think of Yukio being the serious, overly stressed killjoy that he is, not that I don't like Yukio, don't hurt me, Yukio fans, but he sounds completely different. So when I think of that, I think of course talent, but also I just think, like, that's such a range of voice acting of which Fukuyama can do, and I really respect that. But yeah, that's going to wrap it for the Link the VA section segment thing we're doing now for our anime episodes, hopefully. Hopefully you're enjoying these, and I'll see you on the next edition, hopefully in a future episode. But now, back to the show. I actually want to go through another really fun thing, and that is the OP and ED. I probably won't spend as much time analyzing as deep as I did on the other two episodes. I'll try to do a lot of, or a bit more, analysis on the OP versus the ED, but I love these both. I think it's probably the best OP of which I've heard from Uberwild in a long time, or just altogether, completely, and that even disregards Odd Future and all the others, because this one is crazy. This is probably one of my favorite OPs ever in the entire medium. So let's do a bit of analysis on this. So the OP takes place on the basis that Aono Exorcist is back, and it's back in flying colors. It's back after 6 years. Finally, I don't know why it took so long, but it's back, and it's back in full HD. One thing that I think was really cool was how we get the colorful Aono Exorcist logo versus just the blue one we got from the first season. I think it's just a nice way of saying, we're back, we're refreshed again, and presents us with a nice, lovely way of starting the show. But into some of the deeper concepts, I think the opening of the opening, so the first part, is really important. That whole synoptic relationship, or the whole domino effect in relation to development, which we're speaking about, is actually quite dominant in that first part of the OP's imagery. We, of course, get the shot of Rin inside Yukio and Yukio inside Rin, and then tying that together, we get a quick shot of their father. I think just showing Shiro there is a great way of just showing that everything, although the show does suffer a bit from context of its first season to some extent, although I don't think it needed that fully to make it good, I think it just goes to tell us that we haven't forgotten about you, we haven't forgotten about this journey we've come up to, and this is still going to be a roadblock. Of course, I said in our first episode of Aeon Exodus that the first part is literally a setback, and that relationship which is shown in this first part of the OP is needed, and that is rolled over from the first part of the first arc, because we need that in defeating this new and powerful being. Pretty much what I'm trying to say is that we have this rollover of these events of which have occurred in season one, and it makes them seem as almost more valuable now than ever, because we're going up against someone who's bigger and potentially badder than the antagonist or the threat of the first season. Also, the whole nature of the team, the notion of the team which we were speaking about earlier, is not hinted at but kind of shown right in front of us, with not only the groups walking through as well as Rin afterwards with his nice dramatic walk, but also just the still shots of all of the gang, including Mephisto. I don't know why Mephisto's there. He is relevant, but I don't know if I can call him the gang. However, we see all of them. It again just says Aeon Exodus is back. The gang is back together. And kind of feels like a reunion between us and the characters. We've been robbed of you in anime for 6 years. You're finally back. Honestly, I think this OP is a visual flex, if you will, in the way that you have so much more attention to detail, the transitions, the effects, they all look lovely. I'm gonna say this again, Aeon Exodus is back, and it looks better than ever. I don't know how else I can phrase that. We also get a good insight into context as well with the whole Impure King eyes merging together, but the bit that I find really, really, really good is how it all loops back to Rin. Rin, although I wouldn't say sidelined in this season, isn't 100% the main focus or the primary objective. I don't think this is Rin's story. I think this is the team's story. So having Rin being looped back to, I think, is really nice there. The final thing I want to pick up on is just the sound overall. It sounds very chaotic, similar to what you would expect from an Uberworld song, apart from maybe Odd Future, where it kind of has the slow part and then the really dynamic part. Overall, it just sounds amazing. Loads of things going on at the same time. Amazing chorus. The glass breaking sound effect, I can't forget about that. The glass breaking sound effect is great. It's phenomenal. The sound design overall really just pays attention to what this series is about. It's about something larger than before. The scale and the stakes are imitated within the music, and Aeon Exodus, yes, I'm saying it again, Aeon Exodus is back. And now I'm quickly just going to discuss a few things about the ED, which I think were really cool. The ED is, again, probably one of my favorite EDs out there. When it comes to the music in general, the OP, the ED, and even just the soundtrack overall, I think the Kyoto Saga arc just does it all for me. With the ED, I think the cinematography is great, and the meaning within it is great. Everybody feels hopeless. Everyone is sort of down, mostly because of this large challenge, and the whole idea of challenge is really pushed in this. We see the sad faces of our team, again linking back to the whole notion of the team thing that's been going on. We see the team in a different state than usual. They're not enthusiastic, but they're tasked by this large thing that's going on, and how can you expect them not to feel challenged or overwhelmed? And then if we skip right through to the shot of Yukio and Rin sort of standing back to back across opposite ends of the screen, kind of just teases that relationship that they need to have between each other, even with all these other people, which we see in black silhouettes passing by, sort of encroaching within their relationship. All these people like Mephisto and all these other people even from season one trying to get in the way of that. And it comes back to the core idea that they are brothers and they are linked by Shiro, which we get that nice blurred sort of shot of. That link is probably one of the most important links, which you can't get rid of. It's their brotherly relationship, and that will always triumph. I think that's really what the OP tries to say. And then my final part in relation to the ED is just the final shot, of which we get Rin, the camera pulls out, blue sky, he's staring right at us with the Kurikara. I love that shot, it's glorious. It kind of just shows us how serious he is about this. And just like the OP where we get the shot where it all links back to Rin with all the impure king eyes, everything links back to Rin and the sword. This is still his series, and therefore everything or the burdens still lie with him being the son of Satan. So with everything being said, what do I think about the Impure King arc, which you can possibly take away or think about some more? Overall, I think the Impure King arc is pretty decent. Although it does suffer from oversaturation, I think the music really makes up for it. And although its narrative is very separate from its original, I think by itself it does a good job of creating something in a closed space. It does try to make links with things that will occur later in the series. Of course, that will be in manga content. However, I do think that the Impure King arc does try to strengthen what was made in the first series, being the relationships and the notion of the team. It tries to strengthen that in season 2 and then pass on some links and those some fractured and some boosted relationships for the further arcs. So that is going to wrap it up for this episode of the Gets in the Mecha podcast, and I hope you enjoyed the review. I hope you understand where I'm coming from, and hopefully you can take something from it, maybe appreciate the shows a bit more, or see it in a different light. But of course, what did you think? Contact me at getinthemecha@gmail.com, that is getinthemecha@gmail.com, where you can submit an email telling me what you thought, whether it's the Kyoto Saga arc, Aonexus in general, pretty much anything about anime in general, or comic books even. Send in your questions, submissions, opinions, all of that stuff to getinthemecha@gmail.com, and I will try to read about one or two in each episode. Don't forget, check out the show notes. Also, be sure to check out Twitter for updates. That is @getinthemecha, I repeat, so you can receive your updates for when these episodes come out, or your sneak peeks, your audiograms, etc. I would appreciate it largely if you would leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It gives me an idea as to where I can go from here, how I can create better content for all you guys listening. So that's going to wrap it up. Thank you for listening. Check out the previous episode which I spoke about Aono Exorcist on, and also check out last week's episode of which I spoke about Attack on Titan and Erwin's speech. So thank you for listening. Hopefully I'll see you in the next one. So thank you for listening. Hopefully I see you in the next episode. Goodbye. The music in this production goes as follows. Go Lucky by Chasers Gaming. Mandatory Overtime by Joth. The sound effects in today's production goes as follows. Sound effects from Subspace Audio and the cinematic drums sound effect from Alexander under Orange Free Sounds.